Welcome to the South Shore's Morning News Weekend Review Podcast. I'm Rob Hackelow. Listen for the next 30 minutes as we take a look back at some of the big interviews from the week on the South Shore's Morning News, which airs live weekdays from 5 to 10 a.m. The South Shore's Morning News continues. Great to have you along, and every week at this time, we check in with our tech guy, David Snell, over at AxSmart IT in Wareham. David, good morning to you.
And good morning, Rob.
All right, so something else to be aware of, a cyber attack. We're talking about the Change Healthcare cyber attack. Change Healthcare. All right, tell us more about this. This happened in February?
February 21st is when this whole thing started, and it's still an ongoing challenge today. So what happened was Change Healthcare, which is a division or is owned by the United Healthcare Group, and they process 15 billion healthcare transactions a year, involved with one of every three patient records in this country. So it affects a lot of people. This attack has impacted payments for hospitals, physicians, dental offices, pharmacists, and other healthcare providers across the country. Matter of fact, we spent the past couple of weeks getting our dental practices and our healthcare practices onto new insurance processing platforms because Change Healthcare just can't do anything.
Really? Okay. Wow. Okay. I mean, even though they're that big?
Even though they're that big. We don't know if they actually have a backup of the data, but what they did something that the FBI and CSIS says not to do is they paid a ransom. So they paid $22 million to a group named Black Cat. Black Cat is a ransomware as a service group. We've talked about this before. This means that they provide the software and the back-end infrastructure and tech support while their affiliates perpetrate the attacks and in turn receive the lion's share of the payment, usually 70% of any ransom paid.
Wow.
Yeah, it's incredible. So that's for a $22 million payment. That affiliate would amount to about $15.4 million.
Wow, okay. So, they're this ransomware group, and so what are they, I mean, they're trying to get money? I mean, I imagine that's what they're trying to do, right? They get the money?
Well, they're trying to get some cut of the money as they're providing affiliates with the software and the means to hack into groups or companies like they've done. But the problem with this is, in this instance, it appears that Black Cat is not eager to part with that 70%. So they're claiming now that they've shut down and disbanded.
Shut down and disbanded?
Disbanded. So, and it's pretty common in the cyber criminal arena where if you start to get caught or someone's getting close to you, you shut down, disband, and pop up as another name. Black Cat has been a multiple hacker organizations over the years. So this is just another one. But what they've done, they've actually made this worse for everybody by doing this because they've absconded with the $22 million payment. And we know the payment was made to a wallet that was attached to or registered to Black Cat. Mm-hmm. So they've kind of with that, they are not paying the affiliate, and even though Change Healthcare paid $22 million to get the data code to get it released from their service where they could actually use it again and to have the data destroyed, which you never believe the integrity of these hackers anyway, but that didn't happen. The affiliate didn't get paid, and the affiliate states now that they still have that 6 terabytes of data, and they feel they have to monetize it.
But I paid $22
million. Right. But they didn't pay $22 million to the people who actually did the hack.
Oh, okay. Well, see, this is the whole thing I never understand, David, about these ransom. I mean, I understand, you know, they're in a bind. I mean, that's the whole thing with ransom, and you feel like you got to pay it. But then if you don't get the thing back that you paid for, what good does that do?
Exactly. And even if you do get it back, you can't be sure that they haven't installed something on that network that's going to cause the problem again. There's been talk over the years that the same companies get re-attacked within a year or two, and usually they think it's because something was left in the network.
Yeah. So there's no. Yeah. There's a. I'll pay you the $22 million. You'll put everything back normal, and then I have inspection rights of your servers. You can't. You can't do that. I mean, it'd be great if they did that, but they don't. So the really only thing is to. I guess if you have to pay, and you're a big company, you have no choice. But the other thing is really just to keep finding these people and putting them down.
Yeah, chase them down and get them put out of business. But as Black Cat has said, they are just, they've shut down, and they will pop up again in a month or two as a different name, doing the same thing, selling their hacking software to affiliates who maybe they'll be a little bit leery about this if they figure out that Black Cat was the guy who messed over the last affiliate for $15.4 million. So they may not want to do business with them right away, but there's still plenty of people who are going to try to take advantage of this.
Yeah.
For the rest of us.
Criminals not being ethical to other criminals.
Right. So they're certainly not going to be ethical to the then company that they've ransomed and hacked into their systems. You never pay a ransom. That's what you're told.
Yeah.
Never pay a ransom. Bite the bullet. Do what you have to do. It just doesn't seem that Change Healthcare had a good backup across their entire infrastructure.
Yeah.
They're starting to test data now. Just found out yesterday that they're testing some data, but they don't know if it's going to work. And at this point in time, most of their companies that were doing business through them have gone somewhere else.
Yeah.
They couldn't afford not to collect money on their insurance payments. Otherwise, the doctors and hospitals could get out of business without any money coming in.
Wow. Well, a lot of stuff here. And this means that you said there'll be some lawsuits, right?
There's lawsuits happening right now. And for the rest of us, we have to expect that stolen data will be monetized and sold over the coming months, putting us all at even more cybersecurity jeopardy. So on the dark web, which is where this stuff is sold, a Social Security number you get $3, you get $15 for. A credit card you get $3 for, but for a medical record, they sell for $60.
Wow.
So it's important that they have this information and that we as the consumer are the patients are the ones who are going to suffer greatly for this in the future.
David Snell with us from AxSmart IT in Wareham talking about the Change Healthcare cyber attack. You can read the full blog and get some links as well, David, right on your site.
Absolutely. And we'll be keeping an eye on this as it moves forward to see where this all ends up.
All right, David, where do people go?
Let's go to AxSmartIT.com and click on my blog link.
AxSmartIT.com. David Snell, thank you so much.
Thank you, Rob.
David Snell, AxSmartIT.com. David is with us every week at this time on WATD. The South Shore's Morning News. Great to have you here. It's our South Shore Chamber of Commerce segment. Peter Foreman is with us. He is President and CEO of the South Shore Chamber of Commerce. Peter, good morning to you.
Good morning, Rob. You know, the news lead into this segment talked about skill-based employment and the governor's interest in that. We're going to talk a variation of skill-based training for employment this morning. But, you know, last hour you talked about great treasures hidden in walls and time capsules.
Yes.
WATD is redoing its studio. This is the segment you want to put in your wall for the future. For a time capsule, because for the last 20 years, people have looked at ways to leverage the resources of the South Shore in maritime interest and environmental interest with some job training attached to that in education for 20 years. And it is finally happening with the Atlantic Resiliency Innovation Institute. Just received a large federal grant. And the executive director for that is a familiar name on the South Shore. He is the chairman of the Marshfield Chamber of Commerce, Jeremy Devaney, who now wears that second hat as executive director of the Atlantic Resiliency Innovation Institute.
Oh, that's wonderful. Jeremy, great to have you back in studio, by the way.
Thanks so much for having me on, guys. Really appreciate you making time for us this morning. It's a really exciting time for the Atlantic Resiliency Innovation Institute.
Well, absolutely. So why don't you start by filling me and the listeners in on what the Atlantic Resiliency Innovation Institute is. What is it all about?
Sure, Rob. So we're here to incubate talent and solutions for coastal hazard mitigation. So for a long time, the South Shore has been absent of major industry. And as we looked at different ways to stimulate the economy around here, one of the ideas that's been percolating for quite some time originated, like Peter was saying, 20 years ago, Jim Cantwell spent a lot of time looking at Blue U and trying to bring Massasoit to the area and bringing a larger institutional presence to the community. And we've been able to do that by striking a partnership with Northeastern. So Northeastern in their civil engineering department is very excited to take a deeper look at our region's coastal hazard issues. Mm-hmm. But we don't want to get hung up on the issue side of things. We want to drive solutions to market. Marshfield's got a very serious coastal hazard issue. We looked at it back in 2015 when FEMA developed some new maps and we realized how much of our town's asset base was exposed to hazard. Mm-hmm. And at that point, the science wasn't really there for the community to fight those battles very well. And coming out of that, what we learned was we need a science-based community here. We need to have people looking at our issues in particular. The only institutions that are currently looking at the issue in depth is the Army Corps of Engineers Field Research Facility based in Duck Island, North Carolina. And those guys are largely focused on the Gulf Coast in the Florida coast, coastal Carolinas. Very different coastline than we have up here. Mm-hmm. And we were told when we went looking for coastal hazard solutions for our community that those solutions weren't appropriate up here and they wouldn't be passed by the local policymakers. So, again, we need solutions for our community. We need industry for our community. So no better way to do that than developing a talent base here. Mm-hmm. So we can be the next Silicon Valley for coastal hazard solutions.
Okay, a talent base. Yeah, so let's talk about workforce because Peter was mentioning skills-based employment trends. We all know about workforce shortages. So how will the Institute help build the workforce and will we need, in terms of local environmental and marine industries, what will we need in those areas?
Yeah, great question, Rob. So when we took a look at this right now in civil engineering in the state of Massachusetts, there's 600 open seats. Those are all six-figure jobs. They're high paying, they're high education. And so typically to get in those career fields, you're looking at a long schooling. And what we learned through COVID is that there's a huge demand from the population for hands-on hard skills, whether it's plumbers or tradespeople or carpenters or welders. These tradespeople are the people that really are the backbone of us implementing new technologies and solutions to market, whether it's construction or computer science. You need people that can put the equipment together. And so when we started thinking about new solutions we need for the area, it's how do you attract these people here? Mm-hmm. How do you grow these people here and achieve some sort of workforce density? And we had a great example based up in Gloucester. In the life science industry, joined an institution up there called the Gloucester Marine Genomics Institute. So we borrowed their model and we spent a lot of time hand in hand with GMGI up in Gloucester, learning about how they're developing new solutions for the life science industry and at the same time training lab techs. And their lab techs come out of their technology training programs with more lab hours than they do out of the universities in the city. So they're getting great placement in life science from their technology training programs. And they're at the same time, they're developing fully independent science. They've got their own science contracts, and they're going out and developing new solutions for life science.
Wow, this is fascinating. All right, $1 million, the federal grant that Atlantic Resiliency Innovation Institute just received. So it seems like that's a lot of seed money, and it sounds like an ambitious long-term project. What do you think the next few years looks like for a business plan, and how do you think it will be funded?
Great question, Rob. So that seed money is just that, seed money. We've got a lot of staff up that we've got to do to get where we want to be with our vision. We're standing up a full academy. So ARI, the Atlantic Resiliency Innovation Institute, we call it ARI, is going to be the home to the Marshfield Coastal Academy and the Marshfield Coastal Hazard Lab. The Coastal Hazard Lab is where we're working with the Northeastern team to develop some new technologies and study new solutions as they come to market. And the academy is where we're going to train people in civil engineering hard skills and help them get placed. So we're going to run a 9-month training program. You'll graduate with certificates. You'll get placed in internships and go on, hopefully, to a full-time placement afterwards in civil engineering. And those fields of study will largely be around technology management, data management, survey techniques, GIS, big data, all these really certifiable skills that we can train around that are in high demand in the construction industry.
Okay. And I know because time's almost running out, so I'm going to talk a little bit here quickly about your other hat. Chairman of the board for the Marshfield Chamber, Peter was mentioning that, and I know you wanted to give a little plug about what's coming up with the chamber.
Yeah, Rob, really, really appreciate the plug time. So June 6th, 9 a.m. at Hat Ads. If you have investors or if you're a banker and you're interested in investing and partnering in ARI, come on down, Hat Ads. We're having a innovation leadership breakfast to talk about some of the projects we've got going on in Marshfield. But really importantly, we've got some really strong partners that have shown up at the chamber, whether it's Senator Markey and his staff. Jim Cantwell's been a huge proponent of this project. Senator Warren's been a huge help. Our local town hall, our Northeastern partners, the GMGI team. It's been a real community effort. And I think the nexus of that, the community part of that, is all at the chamber. We've seen the leadership from the South Shore Chamber and the Marshfield Chamber has learned a lot of lessons in economic development and community building through that relationship. And we're really proud to take these next steps with ARI and the opportunities that we're bringing to the community to grow our economy and do so in a responsible, long-term way.
Well, Jeremy Devaney, thank you for coming on. Jeremy Devaney, Executive Director of the new Atlantic Resiliency Innovation Institute, ARI, we learned that they're called, and you also know him as Chair of the Marshfield Chamber of Commerce. Some exciting stuff today, Jeremy. This is the kind of stuff I bet that gets you pumped up. This is really exciting stuff, and thanks for, you know, helping us learn a little bit more about it.
Always appreciate you giving us a platform, Rob. You know, the relationship that you've had with our Executive Director at the Chamber, Lara Brayton, and what she does for the community. She's going to be our director of partnerships and industry partnerships for ARI. She's coming on board. Jeff Granatino and the school committee has been a huge proponent of this. We're looking at different ways to give the community of Marshfield opportunities to really punch above our weight. We're a little community, but man, we drive a lot of power into the city of Boston and into the greater region beyond. So excited about the opportunity, excited to have our partners with us.
Watch out. You've heard it here first. We're putting it in the time vault. Jeremy, thank you.
Thank you, Rob.
All right, now let's bring Peter back in because I know he wanted to also get us up to date on the South Shore Chamber.
March 28th, we have one of our Women in Local Leadership interviews with Cynthia Sierra, who is the Executive Director of Manic Community Health, a member of our board, a very impressive leader on the South Shore, and certainly worth coming to listen to her and her perspective on leadership.
It's Peter Foreman. SouthShoreChamber.org is the website. Peter is the president and CEO of the South Shore Chamber of Commerce. Great to have you here on the South Shore's Morning News. Well, as promised, on the line with us for this segment, New York Times bestselling author Stephanie Dre. She's going to be with us to talk about her new book, Becoming Madam Secretary. Great story. The American heroine who transformed a nation. Probably someone that we don't know as much about, and we really should, and I think Stephanie wants to tell us, and in fact, there is some local connections to Massachusetts. Stephanie, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me. And I would just love to talk about her connections to Massachusetts.
Well, yes. So let's talk about this character in history that we need to know about, this important woman, Frances Perkins. Tell me more about her and why you decided to do the research and to write this book.
Frances Perkins was the first woman to serve in a presidential cabinet. She was appointed by FDR, and she really was sort of the architect behind the New Deal. So this was important to me because my family, all four of my grandparents survived the Great Depression, and they talked about FDR in glowing terms and credited him with sort of the survival of the family. And it was just sort of surprising to me to find out that certainly while FDR deserves the credit, so does Frances Perkins, who was sort of one of his best lieutenants.
Yeah, it's so important when I was reading more about this story because I think you're right. We know about some of the characters. We know about the president and maybe you know about the vice president and some of the other key figures, but the cabinet and you were saying this is the first woman ever to serve in a presidential cabinet, and obviously when it comes to FDR, he liked loyalty and he recognized he wanted people that did a great job. And she must have done a great job because she was there, for just all of his time in office?
That's right, all 12 years.
I mean, that's amazing when you think about that, with the turnover you have in cabinets.
That's right, and she was the longest-serving Secretary of Labor in U.S. history.
Wow, and born in Boston, I think she was schooled in this area, went to Mount Holyoke College, so there's a lot of great local ties. Tell me what kind of led her on the path of going, you know, from Massachusetts and then eventually becoming the U.S. Secretary of Labor.
So she did go to Mount Holyoke College, as you said, and I was a Smith College graduate, so yay, Mount Holyoke, my sister school. While she was there, she met Florence Kelly, who was a major reformer at the time, and she was really inspired to help. But she was an unmarried woman, and they sort of expected her to get married or maybe go into teaching, which is what she did. And her teaching took her to Chicago, where she taught at a young woman's academy, Ferry Hall, in Chicago. And when she heard Theodore Roosevelt's inaugural address, where he called on Americans, patriotic Americans, to try to fix the ills of industrialization that were threatening our American experiment, she really felt called to duty. And so she started volunteering at Hull House with Jane Addams, and that led her to what we now call social work. And eventually that would lead her to a career in politics once she met FDR, who at first she was not very impressed by.
Oh, okay. Really? Tell me about how her relationship was, and maybe how it changed or evolved. I'd be curious to hear more about what you found.
It was a lot of fun to find out that the two of them did not hit it off straight away. Francis thought he was a very unimpressive young lawyer, and that he was sort of an arrogant dilettante. Perhaps he thought she was a do-gooder, a sort of boring sort of person, but really they shared a sense of humor and a connection to the American Revolution. Both of them had relations that went all the way back. And over time, they realized that they had more in common than not. And once FDR contracted polio and sort of came back from that and restarted his political career, Frances saw a huge change in him. She thought that he became more compassionate, more empathetic, and he was interested in the common person. And she really admired his fortitude. So together they forged a friendship that really transformed America.
Yeah, and it was thinking about the transformation, as you talked about, the New Deal. And tell me about her role in the policies that we have for Social Security.
Mm-hmm. So when FDR first asked Frances to be his Secretary of Labor, she didn't really want the job. So she gave him a long list of things that she thought he would say no to. And he reviewed the list, and he said, oh, you know, I'll back you on all of these things, except for this social insurance plan, Frances. That's just crazy. So she spent most of her early years as Secretary of Labor persuading him that this was the way to go. And, of course, eventually she did win that battle. He signed on to the plan, and it became the signature of his domestic agenda. Every facet of our lives today is impacted by their work together in the New Deal, and even her work before then in eliminating child labor, setting food safety standards, fire safety prevention. Her legacy is enormous.
Tell me, I mean, obviously you wrote the book, and I know that, Stephanie Dre, you know it's so important, but we really should know more about her. Tell us, you know, how she really is inspiring and paved the way. And as you said, maybe she deserves more credit, like maybe parks and other things. Do we need more? We need to know more about her.
We do. I think she is the most important woman in American history, and I know that's a big claim. But I think when readers pick up this book, they're going to agree with me. So I just think that her legacy has lasted a century, and I can't think of any other woman whose accomplishments have lasted that long or been that impactful in this country. frankly, I can't think of many other men or cabinet members who have had such a long-lasting legacy. Perhaps Alexander Hamilton was the most consequential member of the cabinet before Francis Perkins.
Mm. Stephanie Dray has been with us this morning, and thank you so much for writing this book and for sharing some of this with us today. And we encourage people to go pick it up and order it. StephanieDray.com, StephanieDray.com is her website. You can find out more about all of her books and get in touch with her and find out more about her newsletter. And so this book is available now, correct, in stores and online?
That's right, wherever books are sold.
Becoming Madam Secretary. Stephanie Dray with us today. Stephanie, thank you so much for coming on the program today. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much, and you have a great day.
You too. We hope you enjoyed this podcast. As always, you can find us on your radio at 95.9 FM, mornings from 5 to 10, or online at 95.9WATD.com.
And you can catch up with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can get the links at 95.9WATD.com/SS Morning News. And join us next week for another edition of the South Shore's Morning News Week in Review.